Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on social justice and advocacy. This is episode 27. I'm your host, Salvatore. And on today's episode, we'll be continuing that conversation about disability and CYC practice with a little bit more of a focus on working with autistic youth. I'm very excited to continue on this conversation. As I said in the last episode, this has been my area of interest and expertise for quite some time now in academia, so I'm really excited to get this conversation rolling. We'll be talking with Nancy and Phelim, who I believe are developing or working on a project that's related to young people who are autistic. Nancy and Phelim, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Nancy Marshall. I'm a recent graduate from the new Ryerson Child and Youth Care Master's Program here in Toronto. And my focus is on autism and autistic young people and supporting and working with them and advocacy.
And I'm Fallon Wilton. I am a CYC student actually at Humber right now. And I guess would say I'm an advocate. I also am really interested in like research and how we can support autistic young people and in terms of like, I don't know, my focuses or my interests, I would say probably autism and how it intersects with other identities, trauma, and just taking a really holistic approach. So that's kind of my jam.
That's great. I'm really excited for this. I'm just going to start the ball rolling and just ask the first question, and I'll open it up to you both. Can you explain the use of the term autistic versus autism, and what are the implications of using the different terms?
Mm-hmm. I can start with that. I think I'm going to hand it over to Fallon after every time I start a question. Fallon, being self-identifying as autistic herself, is the best person to answer all of these questions. I'm an ally, not an expert, so I leave it to the young people. So I learned about autistic versus autism, identity first language and person first language, doing a disabilities course in Ryerson a few years ago. And from what I've learned is autistic is, using autistic, and it's shocking when I use it, and I always put it at the forefront of all my papers and stuff of why I choose that language intentionally, is because it's an identity. It's identity first language, and autistic advocates prefer to be called autistic for that. It's not something to be ashamed of or put second to their identity. Having autism or with autism kind of comes second, and it's like separate. And I think CYC practitioners, when they hear me say it, they get shocked because they were taught explicitly to use person first language, person with autism, and I use autistic, so.
Yeah, or has autism, as if it's an accessory, I don't know. I think that person first language started from a place where autistic was kind of seen as a derogatory term, and people were using it to deride others. So in an attempt to humanize, people kind of, especially parents, I'm imagining, kind of put emphasis on the person first. That's the whole kind of idea behind that language. Because autistic people were historically stereotyped and viewed in really limited ways. But then what ends up happening is you kind of have a fracturing of identity there. So anything that you can put under the umbrella of your autistic experience is somehow distanced from your personhood. And I think autistic, instead of saying with autism or has autism, kind of, I don't know, bridges that gap and allows you to, as an autistic person, access your whole personhood without necessarily having to feel distant or separated from that. I like to say that autism is the soil from which identity grows, not a flower in the garden. So it's very foundational because it affects, it shapes memory, cognition, socialization, emotion, sensation, and every other part of the human experience in specific ways that allism, which is not autism, does not experience. And I think, you know, without these foundational experiences, who would I be?
Right.
So how can I say that this is a separate adjunct kind of thing that I have when it's so integral to who I am? And it's okay, and it's more than okay. It's oftentimes a good thing. I mean, it has its challenges, and I don't want to erase that, but yeah, there are lots of amazing things that have happened to me and that I've been able to do, not in spite of being autistic, but because of it. So that is kind of where that language comes from for me and for other advocates. And yeah, I would like to see a movement towards that.
So Fallon said something interesting during my major research project. She was, Fallon was a participant in my major research, and I just loved it. And I titled her story as this, "Autistic is not a slur." And I think that really, you know, for me, really summed it up, what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, I just want to bring it a little bit to the broader disability community, because I know, you know, like labeling does have certain impacts, right? So how else could we use, like not use, I think we said first person? Person first with other disabilities. So, you know, like we have autistic youth. How would we say that with someone, let's say, with a learning disability or someone who has a developmental disability? How can we frame that?
I think it depends on the disability and whether or not, like obviously it depends on the person's preference first and foremost, but I mean, part of the reason why autistic is identity-based language is because there's a lot of autistic culture. I know last month on the podcast she was talking about deaf culture, and I like to call autistic culture a type of neuroculture. So I mean, I guess it really depends on how an individual or that group of people that experience a disability experience it as an identity or a culture. And I mean, I'm disabled. Like, I refer to myself as disabled sometimes as having a disability. Just so that I don't get pushback, but yeah, I'm also physically disabled, and chronically ill, and that is part of my identity too. Not exactly in the same way, but it still does shape a lot of my personal experiences. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't feel the need to again like provide that separation. So, yeah.
I think it's an important point to make because in my research and experience, I have found that when you're labeled with a certain disability, that kind of, I've experienced and talked to young people, that it becomes outside of them. They're not really owning it or seeing it as part of their identity. So I think it's really great that we use the term autistic. I'm just like, yeah, I'm just brainstorming and wondering, like, how would you say someone with a learning
And I do think it's important to listen to families and listen to the young people you're serving, because some will say I haven't experienced it very often, I have to say, actually only once, where they preferred I have autism, and that's only because I brought it up. Most families and young people I talk to actually don't have a preference. They haven't learned about it yet. And then when I say autistic, is that okay? They say sure. A lot of the families, they haven't really thought about it unless there was some kind of education around that piece. So it's very much worth it to bring it up with the families and the young people you're with and ask them their preference. Sometimes they will have a preference, and sometimes they'll just be okay with it.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think that's a great point. It goes back to, I guess, the grounding in CYC practice, which is really taking that individualized approach, mm-hmm. right, and mm-hmm. taking into consideration that lived experience and how they see the world.
And I think it's important to listen to the families and the young people or have that conversation with them rather than just accepting what the textbooks or what the the American Psychiatric Association is telling us to explicitly use person the person first language, because maybe that's not what the young people mm-hmm. want. Like, who's deciding that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Just to move on to the next piece, what are some gaps you've seen within the different, I guess, sectors, we can call them? So the education system, training and services related to young people who are autistic, and how can we better address these gaps?
So for me, the biggest gaps are the gaps in disability rights. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're taught in our education and training at all about the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability, for one, but there's a few other acts here in Canada that protect the rights of people with disabilities, disabled people. And also the concepts of neurodiversity, looking at autism as difference, as a culture, as Fallon said, rather than a disorder. And the social model of disability as well is now becoming a little bit more common, but it really is lacking, where you're looking at disability as a problem based on the barriers in society, not on the person themselves. So those are really important concepts, big concepts that are missing in our education and training. And I think that practitioners often think they need some kind of specialized evidence-based practice to work with autistic young people, and I disagree. I think we need strength-based relational practice with a social justice lens, and that is not being a focus, I think, in our training and education right now in CYC.
I also think the words evidence-based get thrown around a lot, and so even if an approach does have evidence that it works, I always have questions like, okay, who is collecting this data? What is their motivation for collecting this data? For example, I'm just gonna go there. I think about ABA a lot, and
what is ABA?
Applied Behavioral Analysis.
Right.
So for anyone who doesn't know, I guess I could sum it up by being by explaining that it is a behavioral approach to treating autistic young people's distress, is how I would sum that up. So it basically looks at modifying the behavior and replacing, I guess, maladaptive behavior with better actions. And I mean, it's touted as being super evidence-based, but again, a lot of the people who work for the organizations are collecting the evidence, and I mean, even if the behaviors change, my question is, at what cost? Mm-hmm. Because also the thing about ABA is that generally the guidelines is that you commit to 20 to 40 hours a week, and this is for kids as young as 5, mm-hmm. and that is a full-time job. Those are full-time job hours, plus assuming that a child is probably in some sort of form of school, as is the law. And at what point does the child have the right to play? I'm pretty sure the UN does protect that right.
Yes.
And I said this in Nancy's project, but I'll say it again. I mean, what are you going to be nostalgic about when you look back on your childhood, when your therapist gave you candy?
Right.
Yeah. Like, there's just, and I also question methods that need that much time, and not only time in the office, but follow-up at home of constantly, constantly modifying the behavior. It feels like beating a dead horse to me. I don't mm-hmm. know. That seems really aggressive.
So I know within the, I was going to say autism. I'm still trying to.
It takes time. It's okay.
In the autistic community, there is that understanding, and I think a lot of great CYC practitioners understand that there is not one type of autistic youth, right? Mm-hmm. It depends on the young person, and it looks very differently. And that's where I think ABA kind of falls short. But I am curious to know what you both think, and we kind of mentioned it before our podcast, but we were talking about how some families are advocates for ABA. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that. And
yeah, that's all the policies, everything coming out now, particularly in Ontario, is ABA, ABA. That's the best evidence-based mm-hmm. practice for positive outcomes. But these are behavioral outcomes for children. So, and it actually was a big push by parents that got this to be so well funded here in Ontario. What I do think is that the young people being put into these ABA programs are often verbally different than us. They're nonverbal a lot of the times. We're not really getting their consent. That's a problem. Even mm-hmm. when they're older, they should be old enough to give consent over the age of 12 or 14. And because they're nonverbal, they're not trying to get that consent. So we're not thinking creatively enough. And this is just, it's a blanket approach that often misses the individualized, the mark for individualized practice. And we're told as practitioners to follow ABA, just do it because it's evidence-based. It's as if relational and strength-based practice is not enough. Mm-hmm. Like we have to go, and we have to kind of forget that when we're with kids with disabilities, disabled kids and autistic youth, and we have to go with ABA. And it just doesn't make sense to me. We're not, one thing Fallon told me in our project was that we're not really measuring their well-being with ABA or their mental health. Mm-hmm. We're measuring behavioral outcomes. Quiet hands. What are some other ones? Quiet hands, sitting at a desk for a long time.
It's compliance training at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Even when it's well-intentioned and even when the behaviors are harmful, the approach is seeking compliance from the young person.
I think a lot of CYC practitioners in general, and even with particularly within the disability community, when we think of nonverbal, we just go straight to that, what we call evidence based, right? And we kind of forget that there's other therapies, you know, that we could use that could meet the needs of that young person more effective, right? I mean, we have play therapy, we have all these other pieces that mm-hmm. I think are often forgotten. And I mean, I think it's a little bit important to mention that ABA is not necessarily a bad thing, right? I think it does work for some young people, but it's also remembering that we have to take more of that individualized approach and be more flexible in our work with young people.
Because sometimes, I mean, the behavior is an issue, and sometimes right. helping someone figure out a way to substitute it to reduce the cycle of distress can be useful, and I feel like that's where behavioral components can come in really strongly. But yeah, to definitely, because behavior is, when it is problematic, is a symptom of distress, it's important to follow through all the way to where the source of distress is and not just stop it coming up with alternate behavioral solutions.
You know, this kind of reminds me of Heather Snell. She used to be the program coordinator here at Humber CYC program, and she did this. She's not a big fan of CBT, and she was explaining
that. Me neither.
But you know, her thoughts were as, you know, CBT addresses again like that behavior piece, but where do the feelings go? Mm-hmm. Right? And that kind of reminds me about ABA. Mm-hmm. Where does the other stuff go when mm-hmm. we're just concentrating on that one piece? And maybe mm-hmm. we need more of a holistic approach. You both had mentioned well-being. Mm-hmm. So that can mean a lot of things for a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. How would you define it?
Well-being? Well, I think really talking and listening, and I don't mean just listening in an auditory sense. I've worked with lots of autistic young people who are verbally different and nonverbal and just different in lots of different ways. So really engaging and connecting in a way that you can understand, try to understand their worldview and where they're coming from. Remember that they're people just like us. I think I often run into practitioners who think that their behavior is because of their disability, and they forget they may have had a hard morning. They may have all kinds of other systemic issues going on in their life, just like anyone else. So their behaviors are not because they're autistic. They're not behaving for the sake of misbehaving or whatever they want to label it. There's all kinds of stuff. So finding those creative ways to understand where they're coming from. There's, of the CYC characteristics that Tom Garfat has put in place, there's one that I think just really speaks to what I'm trying to do with young people, is get to that needs-based approach. So often we look at, so one example he gave in a training recently was the looking at the external use and the internal use. The external use is just looking the ABC, the antecedent behavior and consequence model in ABA. Often we don't go deep enough with that. So if you're looking at the internal use, you really get to understand and try. They can be nonverbal, that's okay. Finding ways to connect and engage so you're understanding where they're coming from. Use picture symbols if you need to. I prefer photographs other than the prescribed sold ones that they sell you with certain programs. Use sign language. Use creative ways to engage and connect. Play with them and figure out what's going on. There's all kinds of ways you can engage and really listen to young people.
Yeah, because whether it's verbal or not verbal, young people will find ways to tell you when their well-being is at risk and when they don't feel like they have access to that, like, growth and safety. That's what I think well-being is. It's a nice mixture of growth and safety. And they will, like, I don't know, I feel like instead of trying to come up with really precise measures of what it means, let people define it to you and come up with ways together that you can reach those places and even recognize where that well-being already exists in some aspects and kind of augmenting it however you can, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does. We've mentioned nonverbal a couple of times, and I'm just going to bring a little bit to the broader disability community. Often, I've come across, you know, CYC practitioners saying, you have a nonverbal young person, how do we get their consent? They're nonverbal. How do we get to that space where we're not bringing in our own assumptions? We may know that a certain service is going to be very beneficial to the young person, so how do we differentiate between the two?
Yeah, so I've worked with, I have, you've been hearing me say verbally different, I struggle with labels, so I struggle with nonverbal as well, because I've worked with so many autistic young people who have different developmental differences and verbal differences, and I think nonverbal, often practitioners think if they're nonverbal, they have a developmental delay, therefore they learn differently.
That's not always true.
And that's so not always true. So it's just not just nonverbal. It's, you have to look at the developmental stage of each individual, very individualized approach. Sometimes it's as simple as using the photographs, whatever you're using for communication, and repeating it a couple of times at their level that they can. So yes and no, get them to say yes or no. So you really have to break it down. And okay, I want us to do some table work right now, which is a big part of evidence-based practice in ABA. So you show them the photographs of the table work and you wait for them to agree to it or not, for example, things like that. So really breaking it down, really trying to understand the developmental level. And also when you get to know a person and their family, getting all the details from their environment, you can kind of try to intuitively guess if they're gonna wanna do that or not. And sometimes you do have to go that way. And it's often a very intentional and creative process, and it's a lot of fun when you can try to connect and engage with young autistic people with verbal differences. It's quite rewarding. So I don't know how to explain it.
I'm hearing a take their lead kind of approach, which is important, because I think if we worry too much about getting consent, it kind of illustrates to me that it's because we're trying to do something to them. Because having clear-cut yes or no consent often is tied with, can I do this thing to you? Will you do this for me? But if you're doing something together, it's a lot easier to follow that person, that young person's lead, and to kind of reevaluate the different ways consent can look like as you go, if that makes sense. Yeah.
And looking at the goals of what you want to do. Right. Is it a goal? Do you want to achieve, you want them to sit and do this half an hour of puzzle because you need them to sit and do that? Is that your need as a practitioner, or is that their need, and is it going to benefit them? So exactly. Really knowing what is going to benefit the young person, and then figuring out consent from there. That's a good place to start, I think.
So I just want to, I guess, change gears a little bit, and we're going to go down a couple of, past some questions, because I think we've kind of touched upon them. Can you all explain what the difference between mental health and well-being compared to behavioral outcomes are? And are there any drawbacks to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it goes back to what I was just saying, looking at the external behaviors, surface behaviors, as opposed to really getting to know the individual on the inside, looking deep into what they need, where that behavior might be coming from, and get to that. So if they're, you know, externalizing behaviors like swearing at you, for example, thinking of what purpose is that serving for them? Is it a poor self-image that they have? They've grown up with thinking they're disordered their whole life. We call it autism spectrum disorder. So we have to look at those kinds of things and really get to that, you know, their worldview and see. I don't know. Did you want to say anything else about that?
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. So what is the difference between mental health and well-being compared to behavioral outcomes?
Right. Back on track. For me, yeah, I think that behaviors, especially by a list of people, by people who don't exhibit the same behaviors, can easily be seen as problematic when a lot of them aren't. And I guess looking at well-being is how well do those behaviors serve you? And I think well-being looks really different based on not just the person, but also the environment that they're in. I think if we look at resilience as a concept in CYC, some things that may serve a young person in an acute, maybe more traumatic or high-risk situation isn't as beneficial in a more secure, long-term kind of environment. So really, what is that behavior, what is the behavior protecting? How well is it protecting it? And is it sustainable? Are questions that I often ask myself for myself and other people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up. So well-being, going with the swearing and the behavior outbursts, as they like to be called often. Maybe those are good for that kid, right? Mm. Maybe they need that. Maybe they are exhibiting resilience, you know, like if Alan just said. So it's very different, the behavior, and it does have to be individualized. So well-being is about knowing and figuring out what that young person feels.
I hate to cut this conversation short because I can talk for hours about this stuff. But we are running out of time. Maybe we can have you back on the show again, because I think it's a great topic and an important topic to be discussed. But I do have one last question that I guess has become my trademark question for the show. What does advocacy mean to you?
Ellen and I discussed this earlier to try to figure it out.
How are we going to answer it?
I know it is hard to define. It's a big thing. So for me, really advocacy is start from a place of unknowing. So you don't want to do for somebody. It goes into that area of allyship. You don't want to do it for them. You want to do it with them. So it's a mutual thing. Advocacy, listening to the young person, if it's a young person you're advocating for, and just understanding that their truth is their truth. Their lived experience is their truth.
Mm. Yeah, and I think there are two types of advocacy: advocacy for the self and advocacy for others. For self-advocacy, it really becomes a means of, first of all, reflecting on what your needs are, and maybe the ways that they're not being met, and your greater community that you share too. And partnering with people that maybe don't have those struggles to come together and find a solution. And when I act as an advocate or an ally in solidarity with anybody else, I think I like to think of it as being an instrument of change. So I can be moved around and directed and, played in a sense. Mm-hmm. However, that person needs me to. So I'm the instrument, you are the musician. I will announce whatever, go for it. Yeah, that's kind of how I conceptualize the two things.
I mean, I think those are great definitions, so I'm very happy you have explained it like that. Before we end, do you have anything else to say?
No, I think we...
I'm always very grateful to meet people like Fallon, who have taught me so much. The autistic community is my education, so...
And thank you.
And thank you, Salvador. Yeah,
thank you both. I think this is a great way to end. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again to you both for taking the time out to speak with me. If you are a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of what topic we should be talking about, please email me at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak at gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.